This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Ukraine is working to make its national grid operational after Russia's latest airstrikes leave several cities in the dark. Germany is expecting to see a growth in public deficit next year amid a severe energy crisis. And Peru's Congress rejects a bill to hold early elections as violent protests continue over the ouster of former President Pedro Castillo. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, a barrage of Russian strikes has battered Ukraine's grid, knocking out water and electricity services in several regions. The national energy provider has warned Ukrainians it could take longer to restore electricity. It has also imposed an emergency blackout, saying its system had lost more than half its capacity after strikes targeted backbone networks and generation facilities. Russian missiles targeted multiple cities, including the capital, Kiev. The chief commander of Ukraine's armed forces said 60 out of 76 Russian missiles were intercepted and destroyed, but they took a heavy toll on infrastructure and killed two people after a rocket hit a residential building. The Russian-controlled eastern Lugansk region also hit by Ukrainian shelling and has left at least 11 people dead and many wounded. Moscow and Kiev have stepped up attacks against each other's positions in recent weeks. Gilbert Doctorow joins us from Brussels. Gilbert, welcome. We're seeing more and more attacks over the past few weeks between Russia and Ukraine. Is this perhaps a reaction from Ukraine to receiving more advanced weapons from the West, or is this a reaction from Moscow, which is trying to end the war, or are we just seeing a stalemate in this mess?
We're not seeing a stalemate, but we are seeing Russia prosecute this war under very interesting conditions that it has determined, with a view towards gradual escalation and towards controlled escalation, which will not lead to a nuclear war. That has to be the paramount interest of Moscow, to get what it wants on the ground in Kiev, in Ukraine, without provoking a nuclear war. And in this sense, the destruction of the infrastructure of power in Ukraine has its peculiarities, which are in no way discussed in media. I don't claim to have superior knowledge. I do have an interest in exploring what these questions mean, what destruction is going on. This is not total destruction of power generation, nothing of the sort. If the Russians wanted to leave Ukraine without any electricity, it is totally within their capability of doing that by using high-powered explosives on large missiles or cruise missiles that are not susceptible to interception by any existing air defense systems. The Russians are not doing that. They have the capability of doing that, but they're not doing it. In your description of what they have done, you mentioned in passing two elements. One is power generation, which the Russians have hardly touched. And the second is power distribution, which they have massively touched. Power distribution can, in fact, be restored within a matter of months. power generation cannot be restored in anything less than a timeline of years. And it is to avoid the total destruction of Ukraine as a viable state that the Russians have held back and have directed relatively low-power drone attacks on primarily distribution and not on generation.
Okay, Gilbert, thank you very much indeed for that. Gilbert Doctorow there, joining us live from the Belgian capital, Brussels. And speaking of Brussels, thousands protest on the streets of the city demanding more support to deal with a growing cost of living crisis. Many of those who took part questioned how the EU can send billions of euros to Ukraine while neglecting the basic needs of citizens across the 27-country bloc. Jerome Hughes reports from the Belgian capital.
Claim the country's federal government and EU authorities are failing to adequately help citizens during the current escalating cost of living crisis. Many also question how the EU is able to set aside at least 20 billion euro for Ukraine in 2023.
We are all against this war because it's about imperialism, it's about money. There's more behind. It's not only about Ukraine and about Russia.
Ukraine is a key point, but our people here as well. And the money is there. People have to be taxed properly, especially the 1%.
It's important to help the Ukrainians, but what about the people here in Europe and in Belgium?
The EU's energy sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine have backfired. Oil, gas, diesel, petrol and electricity prices are through the roof. Inflation across the eurozone is running at 10%. However, wages are not going up.
Many people can't buy the good food. Many people can't pay for our apartment.
Landlords are taking advantage from the inflation to raise the rents.
Landlords will now have another excuse. The European Central Bank increased interest rates by a half of 1% on Thursday.
And based on the substantial upward revision to the inflation outlook, we expect to raise them further.
The national strike on Friday resulted in flight cancellations, according to Brussels Airport. There were also major disruptions to tram, bus and metro services. Union members, not just here in Belgium, but across the EU, are warning of protests throughout 2023, which will impact public services, unless their cost of living concerns are addressed. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Turning to Germany now, which says its public deficit will grow 3.25% next year as the energy crunch pushes the government to dip further down into its pockets. Finance Minister Christian Lindner warned that if government spending goes up, that figure could reach 4.5%. The government has unveiled a 200 billion euro plan to dampen the effect of soaring energy prices for the public. Part of the plan is to put a cap on gas prices for households and businesses. However, German economy is still expected to contract by 0.4% in 2023. The country expects its net borrowing to climb above 45 billion euros, nearly triple the initial estimates. Peru's Congress has rejected a bill to hold early elections, which is aimed at ending the deadly protests over the ouster of President Pedro Castillo. The proposal was to move the elections from 2026 to December 2023. It fell short of the 87 required votes. Castillo's successor, Dina Boluarte, had called for the snap vote to ease an ongoing unrest, which has so far killed 18. The Supreme Court has extended the pretrial detention of Castillo for another 18 months. The leftist ex-president was impeached and arrested after he announced plans to dissolve the Congress and rule by decree. The Peruvian Defense Ministry declared a 30-day state of emergency after all-out protests and roadblocks following Castillo's arrest last week. Academic and political analyst Bruno Biaclini tells us about the origins of the current crisis in Peru and how it can be resolved.
These rules by the Peruvian constitution, they were set up by Alberto Fujimori's self-coup d'etat who was backed up by the USA and by the armed forces. So nobody will respect these rules, and nobody will respect a president who does not have a majority in the Congress. That's the problem. Pedro Castillo is a legitimate president. He comes from a legitimate social struggle as a teacher and as a peasant and as an indigenous. But without having a majority in the Congress, it's almost impossible to rule Peru. That's why Peruvian capitalism is self-autonomous from the political structure. For example, they do have free trade with China, free trade with US, and the financial district Lima, they almost do not concern about what happens in Congress and what happens in the palace of the president. It's sad, but it's true. They have an autonomous capitalist zone over there. The hope now is that the civil resistance will go as further as possible and establish a new election and establish a new constitution, or at least a new social pact to build a political system more established. More established. Otherwise, it will be impossible to rule Peru, impossible to govern over there, impossible.
Now, the families of the victims of a stampede in the South Korean capital, which claimed 158 lives, have gathered to hold a candlelight vigil. 26 foreigners, including 5 Iranians, died in the tragedy, information revealed. In the aftermath of the stampede showed the police failed to respond to repeated emergency calls. Frank Smith reports from Seoul.
The family members of the victims of the Itaewon tragedy and thousands of their supporters remembered those 158 mostly young people whose lives were taken in a crowd crush October 29th. Some read letters to their lost loved ones.
Last year, we made a whole bunch of snow ducks all around outside our apartment. Please come and see me in my dreams sometimes. Please come see me someday, maybe even as my future child. I love you forever, Seon.
Although tens of thousands were gathered, police did not manage the crowds and ignored emergency calls hours before the deadly crush. Among those who perished in the tragedy, 26 of them were foreigners. 5 of those were Iranian. And like many of the young people who died that evening, they were students who visited South Korea to get more experience in the world and primarily more education to better themselves. Victims' families want the truth and those responsible brought to justice. A class action lawsuit is suing the government, which has often deflected responsibility and blamed the victims. It reminds some of the ferry sinking in 2014, in which more than 300 people died.
The law should be a law to punish wrong people, but the government is humiliating, insulting, and degrading the victims and the families of the deceased. In the end, I think this happened because the Sewol ferry accident was not properly resolved.
Tonight marked the 49th day since the tragedy, signifying the end of the mourning period, when the spirit of those dead to be reborn reaches Buddha and bliss. Frank Smith, Seoul.
India's economy continues to be on a consistent track and is posting as the fastest growing among major economies. Experts say this would pave the way for the South Asian nation to become the world's third largest by 2030. That is, Manawa Zaman reports from New Delhi.
It's a daybreak. Raju Yadav is piling up his stock for the delivery in the retail market. He's delighted, saying markets are picking good pace and prices in the whole markets are not fluctuating since last quarter. Earlier, I would buy limited stock, he says. But since the prices are consistent and demand is satisfactory, I have bought more stock than usual. I'm testing my luck, he says. Many Indians like Raju are optimistic as the country is picking up pace as the fast-growing major economy.
We are not strictly a very heavily exporting nation. Most of our producers actually rely on our domestic market. But exports are important for us because we do import some very critical commodities.
Experts say with COVID outbreak shaking major economies, India maintained its consistency in almost all sectors except the manufacturing and employment, which they say is like a diesel engine and needs a major boost. Many economic experts say investments are flowing smoothly in the world's second most populous nation, adding the country needs to revitalize its manufacturing sector, job creation, and address bottlenecks in power, mining, and infrastructure.
More than the economy, I would say our problem, what the manufacturing sector can boost is good jobs, you know, which all Indians will agree are lacking in India. I mean, that's why so many of us go abroad, right? Because these good jobs are lacking, we are wasting our talent. And the reason is that we have never seriously thought about how to make manufacturing grow.
India growth forecast is projected at 7% despite turbulent markets and war in Ukraine that shook markets. Based on Morgan Stanley and S&P Global, the country is projected to overtake Japan and Germany to become the third largest economy by 2030. Economic experts say trade tensions between the United States and China will also open up new opportunities for India, as the companies are considering India for production capacity as a second option. Many, however, argue India needs double-digit growth, which would be vital for the second most populous nation, where a huge workforce and young professionals join the market every year, besides lifting millions out of poverty. While the coronavirus pandemic ravaged the world's economy, India managed to mitigate the impact of the outbreak, mainly by relying on its domestic market. But experts say the economic growth is expected to fall in the coming months as the country grapples with high inflation, rising unemployment, and a spike in oil prices, and also a threat of global economic recession. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Now, Malaysian rescue workers are combing through the site of a deadly landslide for a dozen campers missing after the Friday incident. Search and rescue operations resumed Saturday morning after they were halted overnight due to heavy rain. Local officials, however, have not held out much hope of finding the missing campers alive. And that's because of the lack of oxygen and weight of the soil in the area they're possibly trapped in. The landslide hit an unlicensed campsite in a popular hilly area near the capital, Kuala Lumpur. It happened when campers were sleeping in their tents. Around two dozen people, including five children, were killed. Following the incident, Malaysia ordered the closure of campsites considered as high risk. Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
aperture.
Situated in a relatively remote desert at the Negev Nuclear Research Center, the Dimona reactor is a heavy water-moderated natural uranium-fueled reactor. Most independent analysts believe that in the mid-1970s, Israel upgraded the installation to generate between 70 and 150 megawatts. Now that output makes it not only the region's largest reactor, but the sole evident producer of plutonium and tritium for nuclear weapons. And although Israel neither confirms nor denies its atomic arsenal, experts believe that it's been a nuclear-armed regime now for several decades. I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. While the Zionist regime of Israel has maintained its decades-long policy of deliberate ambiguity about its weapons of mass destruction, its deadly arsenal is not the only danger threatening lives. The very existence of the Dimona is a terror haunting Jordan and Israel's other neighboring countries. A higher rate of cancer and the constant fear of possible malfunctions at the reactor are some of the worries that locals must deal with on a daily basis. And the Israelis are aware of the possibility of a meltdown at the Dimona reactor, a meltdown that would affect an area reaching Cyprus and the entire neighboring region. What makes these concerns even more pressing are satellite images of the Dimona reactor, which show that its walls have cracks which could cut its life by half. Join us this week's documentary exploring the threats that Dimona is posing on its neighbors.
Let's talk about Dimona. Many people say, well, nobody knows.
You see, I blush, you say Dimona and I blush. We're not supposed to talk about Dimona. But
why?
Go ahead. Because it's a taboo. It's a taboo, it's a secret.
Negev Desert, south of Israel. This mysterious complex away from the public eye employs thousands of people, all sworn to secrecy. When its existence was discovered, Israel said it was a textile factory, never admitting its true purpose, making plutonium for atomic bombs. We need answers. And we go to meet one of the few people in Israel that knows what is going on inside Dimona.
We are dealing with this element of weapons of mass destruction, meaning nuclear, chemical and biological. We're the only NGO dealing with this right now in Israel. When you believe that these are the weapons that keeps you safe, when this is the common belief, then the question raised, are we the next country to use them? Israel is a nuclear armed state, chemical armed state, and biological armed state. Nuclear weapon is not a weapon that aimed at an army. It's a weapon that destroys a city. Are we willing to destroy any city in the Middle East? Mothers, children, fathers, citizens, not soldiers.
Want to know more about the most secretive nuclear program in the world?
Just transmitted at the request of the.
Is the Israeli nuclear plant at Dimona poisoning and threatening the lives of millions throughout the Middle East? From Tel Aviv, we go south. Our destination, Dimona. Approaching a nuclear plant is a high risk. The highway splices through the heat and sand of the Negev Desert. A barbed wire fence edges the road. Signs posted every few hundred meters warn drivers not to stop their vehicles under any circumstances.
They have cameras, they will see.
This is a military zone.
It says don't go off the road. Shoot your ass, military zone, no photography.
finally, we can have a distant look at one of the world's most secret facilities. An exclusive view of a secret Israel is hiding since the 1960s. Dimona Nuclear Plant.
That's the gate. Go inside.
Only a few people in the world can say they know each corner of Dimona Nuclear Plant. All of them are sworn to secrecy. But there is someone that knows exactly how the building looks like.
It was a secret competition with the design of the civic center of a new atomic research center that was to be built in Dimona, in the south part of Israel. For security reasons, we couldn't call it a big center of research, what it was called, a civic center in the Negev. In the 60s, it wasn't such big news to have a textile factory in Dimona. So if you built something large in Dimona, you could very easily say, you see, this is a textile factory. Only that this textile factory had a dome and very... wasn't typical of textile things, but it wasn't seen from the road. It was kind of an agreed quietness. I have the photograph. While the project was being built, not when it was occupied. Then at that time, the security eye was not that strong. So I took the photographs. Later, many years afterwards, I all of a sudden got several photos from an unknown source, but with a stamp of the censorship. So I understood that somebody from the site sent me photos that were taken there. There's a sign that I can open my small portfolio and make it public. The courtyard of the main building, from the other side, looking towards the entrance. The detail of the stairs leading from the to the roof. You can have a roof cover, as you see here. You can go up to the roof under cover. There's a kind of...
This message is transmitted at the request of the United States
when
Office
President
of
Kennedy
Defense.
Took office, he knew from a CIA secret report that Israel was developing a nuclear program in the Negev. At the beginning of January 1961, Kennedy met the Israeli ambassador in Washington and expressed that the USA wanted to inspect Dimona to be sure about its purposes. Israel accepted, but under one condition, if it was done on a secret basis. For 5 months, the visit of the American inspectors to Dimona nuclear plant was postponed several times by Israel. Finally, an ultimatum from USA was accepted. Two American scientists were allowed to visit Dimona in May 1961. Israel imposed several rules on the American inspectors. They were not allowed to take any pictures or issue any comments about Dimona. When the inspectors finally entered the plant, they were misled. They were shown a fake control room on the ground floor. 12th of January 1961, the aim of the building built in the Negev was clear. In a high-level meeting between President Eisenhower and his staff, the US Secretary of Defense informs the president based on intelligence findings, Israel was lying, and Dimona was not for peaceful purposes. They were unaware of the six floors below where the plutonium was made. In search of answers, we travelled to Berlin in Germany. Here we are going to meet Xantha Hall. She is an expert in nuclear weapons and the director of International Positions for the Prevention of Nuclear War. Xantha Hall is also the coordinator of the European Parliament Commission Against Nuclear Proliferation.
The Israel Atomic Energy Commission is one of the most secret institutions in the world. It's responsible for Dimona. Its chairman is Netanyahu, but it's not even officially recognized as existing. All the other nuclear plants in the world are monitored by the Atomic Energy Agency, but not the ones in Israel. So we think it's about time that Dimona was also monitored. The one thing that needs to happen is that an independent body like the IAEA would go into Dimona and find out what is going on there, what is the state of the substance of the building, is the containment of the nuclear reactor still intact, what are they doing about cooling, where is the nuclear waste being stored, how is it being stored, and all these questions, they need to be answered. We need some transparency.
Israel has not ratified the Non-Proliferation Treaty, a way of avoiding inspections to its nuclear sites.
First of all, we are not obliged. We are not part of the treaties. We never signed the treaties, so we don't oblige. We never said we won't. That's one thing. Second thing is the US. And the third thing is the Holocaust.
How?
Guilt. Do you see Germany? Germany sold us the submarines. The US, they let us steal uranium. You go to the UN, to the NPT, to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and you hear the US delegation reading their statements, and when they talk about Israel, you see paragraphs that you know from the language was written by Israelis.
So Israel has a special treatment?
Yes, we're a special case.
Yoshi Melman is known as an investigative journalist, specialized in intelligence and strategic affairs. He was described by WikiLeaks as an information mule who has exchanged tips with the Mossad. But in 2009, Melman uncovered a terrible secret about Dimona. Workers at the nuclear reactor facility were made to volunteer to drink uranium in 1998 as part of an experiment.
The workers themselves already cannot say anything. They have so many contracts saying that they cannot say. The question is the family. So usually in order for them to get compensation, the families also have to say they will not sue, they will not say, they will not speak to the media, and so on. So we know only when they have settlements, when the court say settlement, that they give some money, but we don't know how much usually, and we don't know how many, and we don't know what conditions. And also their doctors are only doctors that work with the commission.
I mean, if you only have a nuclear reactor that is making energy like Chernobyl or Fukushima, that's just one thing. You have lots of possibilities for accidents, but if you've got added to that, you've got uranium enrichment, you've got plutonium reprocessing, and you have actually the making of the warheads, then you have, you know, many more possibilities. Have there already been accidents? There's been some rumors and speculation that in 1966 there was a criticality accident at Dimona. We don't know what's been happening in that plant, and actually it seems that there's probably more secrecy than there was in the Soviet Union, because quite quickly after the Chernobyl accident it was actually said that there had been the accident. So I think Israel is more better to compare on the level of secrecy about a nuclear program with perhaps North Korea. because we know nothing about their program either. We do know that they have one, and at least North Korea is making claims that it has nuclear weapons, whereas Israel is pretending that it doesn't. So I'm not trying to say that there will be worse or better, but there are many more possibilities, so the risk is definitely higher.
Our next stop in search of answers about the Israeli nuclear program and its secrets is a Palestinian village. Dahria, very close to Dimona, and a military field where Israel might be burying nuclear waste from Dimona. In Dahria, a Palestinian doctor struggles to keep Dimona's victims alive. Cesium is not present in nature and can only be found in areas where a nuclear disaster or test takes place.
We know how cesium works on the body because of Chernobyl and Fukushima. Both of those accidents showed us a lot of about how cesium actually affects human health, and that there are claims that there has been a study that has found cesium in the region, and cesium is an indication that something has happened with a nuclear activity. It most likely would be, depending on the amount of it, would be from a nuclear accident, or it could be from leaking radioactive waste.
In some areas of Palestine, the presence of cesium is at the same levels as in Chernobyl or Fukushima, places where the worst nuclear accidents took place.
It's a radioactive isotope. It has a half-life of 30.2 years, and it acts like potassium or like salt. It's water soluble, so it can spread very quickly through the body, and it tends to concentrate then in muscle tissue. And you also have muscles in certain organs like heart and stomach and intestines, so that's where often cesium will end up, and at that point it starts then to mutate the cells within those muscles, and you end up with cancer of the colon, cancer of the stomach, of the lungs sometimes, and it can lead to heart disruption.
There are many rumors about where they bury the waste, but my, and not just my, estimations are that all the materials are buried in the area surrounding the reactor, and the reason is that these materials are secret. They don't want people to go and take lead samples or go with Geiger.
The Geiger counter is an electronic device that measures the level of radioactivity. These devices are allowed for use everywhere in the world. It is sold everywhere, even online, but not in Israel. Despite claiming to be democratic, Israelis cannot buy a Geiger counter inside Israel.
One of the major problems that we have, again, it goes back to the secrecy problem, is that we can't even measure the amount of radiation in the area, because that's not allowed. And the Israeli law even says that if you take a Geiger counter into the area around Dimona and measure the radioactivity, you could be then sentenced to 15 years in prison. So nobody's going to do that. I know people even thought about doing it, but they didn't. It's certainly very risky to try to do any research on this at all, which is why number one problem is to get rid of the secrecy.
What is the security of Israel, and why the security of Israel is so different than the security of the people that live in Israel. And we hear rumors about buildings where the levels of cancer is unbelievable. And when we wanted to ask doctors, we also didn't get any answers. And one funny or sad answer we got was that we cannot measure the amount of cancer, radiation-related cancer in Israel, because we had so many people coming from Chernobyl, from Kiev, and that changed the numbers. So that was one answer we got. And of course, this is not a serious answer. People in Dimona are not rich, most of them. This is, if they were rich people, they wouldn't live next to a reactor, I guess. They wouldn't be depending on this reactor for their livelihood. A few years ago, they all got iodine pills that were very old iodine pills, and that was it. And they're not asking, and that's the problem, that they're more afraid to talk about it than the radiation.
But there are more cases around Palestine. In a small village lost in Al-Khalil Hills, there are other victims. One of them has already died. His son fears the consequences of telling his father's story and only accepts to talk if we protect his identity. But this and many other cases come from the same region.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sador Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is
For a Better Life.
For a Better Life.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
What if all this time, all this struggle has been leading you to a beautiful chapter in your life? What if everything does work out, even if it doesn't seem like it is right now? What if who I become is who I've needed all along? What if all of this hard work leads to amazing things? What if you replace negativity with optimism? Would your thoughts and behavior change too? I believe so. If only it were that easy to put the world back how it meant to be. Yes, yes, this is For a Better Life. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, my dear friends. I am Asma, and I feel beyond pleased to be with you in a new episode of our journey to a better life. As for today, let's talk about things we did and we shouldn't have done, and the other side of the story. So there are many times in life when we come to think that, okay, what if I didn't do this? And what if I took the other side of the story? There are many of these questions that sometimes pop into our head and change everything upside down. Well, you know, I'm mostly the kind of a person who feel like she doesn't regret anything, because the decisions I make, I give them all of my heart. In a way, every time when I am given actually a choice to make a decision between a road and the other, then I give all of my heart to it. And I think, okay, this is your time and you have to take the one that is more desired according to you and according to your thoughts. But then, even if you are this fastidious about the decisions you make, there are some certain times in life in which you think you should have done better, you could have acted better, you could have decided in a more better way that could suit your life in a more pleasing way. The result would have been sort of more desirable. The truth is, living a life as human being in a world with full of complexion, everything is very difficult. Making decision is not as easy as it sounds. It is true that sometimes we fail to make perfect choices, but in the end, that is the decision we have made right at the moment. And of course, we should not forget about the effect of situation and the occasions that we are in. Sometimes the environment, the things that surround you, the people even, those who are your family, your friends, every single fact around you is going to have an effect for the decisions that you make for your future. And of course, as I just told you, when you give it all of your heart, apart from all the conditions and the situations you were in, then you would actually think that, okay, I have done all of my best and there's no way for me to think that I could have done better. But as I just told you, there is this thing that comes and pricks your balloon of happiness of making all the decisions based on whatever you thought is going to be the best way to do. And then makes you sad. I don't know why, but it happens many times. You make a decision and then you look back and then you say, what if I have taken the other way? What if I went through that untrodden road that nobody has taken a chance to get into it? Of course, things are very complicated as we are human beings, and we sometimes do mistakes and then the situation turns against us. So the ugly part about making decision is exactly this part, that you come to do something wrong and then the failure gets into your way and then you have no word to justify yourself. That's the whole story with making decisions, you know. We are just talking about decisions we make, the chances we take, and then the result that happens in our life and how we deal with it and all of these things. But let's go for a short break and then we'll be back after no time. Thank you for listening.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. Well, you're listening to For a Better Life. I am Asma, your friend, and it's been quite some time that I've been talking to you about how to get into a better life. Actually, we are talking about some certain topics that are going to improve us and make us develop a better understanding of life, of ourselves, and of how to attain the things that we wish to make out of our life. Yeah, we were talking about how to make perfect decisions and how not to regret the days that are gone and how to think of the days that are no more and then have no regret upon them. Well, the truth is, as I just told you, the gist of the previous part that we talked is that, okay, we are human beings in life. In a daily basis, we could get into situations that we have to decide. And then these decisions are not all of them are not going to be. And these decisions are going to be different. And not all of them are going to be according to what we wished actually to act. And sometimes we even do wrong decisions. And they are going to lead us to nowhere, and then we're going to feel like a broken piece, and then, you know, how the story goes, because it happens to all of us, and as human beings, well, it hurts too much. And the thing about making decisions and regrets, usually, is that they will conquer your heart fully, and then they will make you feel so sad and oppressed, and sometimes petrified, terrified, and so feeling like, oh my God, is it all the wrong thing that I have done to myself? Well, now, how is to heal ourselves? What is the remedy? Is there any way to feel soothed by? I would say, well, there are some, this, well, in order just to be honest, I would say in some occasions, well, things are very difficult. I can just say, yes, you can think positive and then everything is solved. It's true that it works for some people with some big, great ocean-like hearts, but for some others who are a little bit weak, or perhaps they have this this sort of, you know, the picture of a fledgling bird that is trying to learn how to fly, for these kind of people, it is sort of very difficult to cope up with difficult situations. And what happens is that, you know, be honest with ourselves. This was all that I could have done with the chance that has came into my way. And this was all the thing that I could have created out of it. So just get honest with yourself. Just be a little bit of realistic, you know. Being realistic is going to hurt less than being optimist. I guess so. I don't know if it's the same according to you. I'm sure it might not be for many people. But that's just from my perspective. Whenever you come to a situation, when you think about the what ifs of your life, try to think about this reality that you are a human being with restricted abilities and you are not a wonder person. You cannot do wonders, and it's not about magic and fairy tale stories. Life has so much of ups and downs. We have to cope up with different situations, and it is not only me the one who decides. Sometimes the situation decides for me, and sometimes no matter how much I go against different facts that are around me, I finally have to surrender. I have to give up, and I have to just accept the reality, and that's all. Yes, don't get sad for things that really are out of your control, and you cannot just control them. You cannot improve them in a way that would turn out to be something good for you. Don't get upset for these things. Just try to look forward. If you lost chances in the past, it's okay. You can have them back in the future, because you know how the ways of life work and how God is always there for us. So He would never leave us alone. If we lose anything in the past, then there are big chances for us to attain them in a beautiful future. And that's life. Yeah. Thank you. This was all the time that we had for today's episode. Until another session, I bid you farewell. May Allah protect you and shower you with His blessings. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, He knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, He knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, He knows. Every thought I have and every word I share, He knows.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.